Chapter 9. The Golden Years. It is in the past 40 years that Modena has really seen the great leap forward. The era from Italian unification until then had been a long age of waiting, or of slow and intermittent modifications, before transformation accelerated to the speed of lightning. People now came to enjoy a standard of living previously confined to a tiny elite. G. Muzzioli. No hungry man who is also sober can be persuaded to use his last dollar for anything but food, but a well-fed, well-clad, well-sheltered, and otherwise well-tended person can be persuaded as between an electric razor and an electric toothbrush. Along with prices and costs, consumer demand becomes subject to management. J.K. Galbraith, The New Industrial State. 1. Most human beings operate like historians. They only recognize the nature of their experiences in retrospect. In the course of the 1950s, many people, especially in the increasingly prosperous developed countries, became aware that times were indeed strikingly improved, especially if their memories reached back to the years before the Second World War. A British Conservative premier fought and won a general election in 1959 on the slogan, "You've never had it so good," a statement that was undoubtedly correct. Yet it was not until the great boom was over in the disturbed 70s, waiting for the traumatic 80s, that observers, mainly to begin with economists, began to realize that the world, particularly the world of developed capitalism, had passed through an altogether exceptional phase of its history, perhaps a unique one. They looked for names to describe it, the 30 glorious years of the French, les Trente Glorieuses, the quarter-century golden age of the Anglo-Americans. The gold glowed more brightly against the dull or dark background of the subsequent decades of crisis. There are several reasons why it took so long to recognize the exceptional nature of the era. For the USA, which dominated the world economy after the Second World War, it was not all that revolutionary. It merely continued the expansion of the war years, which, as we have seen, had been uniquely kind to that country. It had suffered no damage, increased its GNP by two-thirds, and ended the war with almost two-thirds of the world's industrial production. Moreover, just because of the size and advance of the US economy, its actual performance during the golden years was not as impressive as the rate of growth of other countries, which started from a much smaller base. Between 1950 and 1973, it grew more slowly than any other industrial country except Britain, and, what is more to the point, its growth was no higher than in the most dynamic earlier periods of its development. In all other industrial countries, including even sluggish Britain, the Golden Age broke all previous records. In fact, for the USA, this was, economically and technologically, a time of relative dropping back rather than of advance. The gap in productivity per man-hour between it and other countries diminished, and if in 1950 it enjoyed a national wealth, GDP, per capita double that of France and Germany, over five times that of Japan, and more than half as large again as Britain, the other states were fast catching up and continued to do so in the 1970s and 1980s. Recovering from the war was the overwhelming priority for the European countries and Japan, and for the first years after 1945, they measured their success simply by how close they had come to a target set by reference to the past, not the future. In the non-communist states, recovery also meant putting the fear of social revolution and communist advance, heritage of war and resistance, behind them. While most countries, other than Germany and Japan, were back to their pre-war levels by 1950, the early Cold War and the persistence of powerful communist parties in France and Italy discouraged euphoria. In any case, the material benefits of growth took some time to make themselves felt. In Britain, it was not until the middle 1950s that they became palpable. No politician before then could have won an election on Harold Macmillan's slogan. Even in so spectacularly prosperous a region as Italy's Emilia-Romagna, the benefits of the affluent society did not become general until the 1960s. Moreover, the secret weapon of a society of popular affluence, namely full employment, did not become general until the 1960s, when the average of West European unemployment stood at 1.5%. In the 1950s, Italy still had almost 8% out of work. In short, not until the 1960s did Europe come to take its extraordinary prosperity for granted. By then, indeed, sophisticated observers began to assume that, somehow, everything in the economy would go onwards and upwards forever. There is no special reason to doubt that the underlying trends of growth in the early and middle 1970s will continue much as in the 1960s, wrote a United Nations report in 1972. No special influence can now be foreseen which would at all drastically change the external environment of European economies. The Club of Advanced Capitalist Industrial Economies, the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, revised its forecasts for future growth upwards as the 1960s advanced. By the early 1970s, they were expected to be, in the medium term, over 5%. It was not to be. It is now evident that the Golden Age essentially belonged to the developed capitalist countries, which throughout these decades represented about 3/4 of the world's production and over 80% of its manufacturing exports. One further reason why this specificity of the era was only slowly recognized was that in the 1950s the economic upsurge seemed quite worldwide and independent of economic regimes. Indeed, initially it looked as though the newly expanded socialist part of the world had the advantage. The growth rate of the USSR in the 1950s was faster than any Western countries, and the economies of Eastern Europe grew almost as rapidly, faster in hitherto backward countries, slower in the already industrialized or partly industrialized ones. Communist East Germany, however, lagged behind non-communist Federal Germany. Even though the Eastern Bloc of Europe lost pace in the 1960s, its GDP per capita over the whole of the Golden Age still grew slightly faster, or in the case of the USSR, just less, than that in the major capitalist industrial countries. Still, in the 1960s, it became clear that capitalism was forging ahead rather than socialism. Nevertheless, the Golden Age was a worldwide phenomenon, even though general affluence never came within sight of the majority of the world's population, those who lived in countries for whose poverty and backwardness the experts of the UN tried to find diplomatic euphemisms. Though the population of the Third World grew at a spectacular rate, the numbers of Africans, East Asians and South Asians more than doubled in the 35 years after 1950, the number of Latin Americans rose even faster. The 1970s and 1980s once again grew familiar with mass famine, its classic image, the starving exotic child observed after supper on every Western TV screen. During the golden decades, there was no mass starvation except as the product of wars and political madness, as in China. Indeed, as population multiplied, life expectancy stretched out by an average of 7 years, even by 17 years if we compare the later 1930s with the later 1960s. This means that food production rose faster than population, as it did both in the developed and in every major area of the non-industrial world. In the 1950s, it rose by more than 1% a year per capita in every region of the developing world except Latin America. And even there, it grew per capita, though more modestly. In the 1960s, it still rose in all parts of the non-industrial world, but, once again with the exception of Latin America, this time ahead of the rest, only very slightly. Nevertheless, the total food production of the poor world in both the 1950s and 1960s rose faster than in the developed world. In the 1970s, the disparities between different parts of the poor world make such global figures useless. By then, some regions, such as the Far East and Latin America, were drawing well ahead of their population growth, whereas Africa was falling behind by more than 1% a year. In the 1980s, the poor world's food production per capita did not grow at all outside South and East Asia, but even here some countries produced less per head than in the 1970s, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, the Philippines. Certain regions stayed well below their 1970 levels, or even continued to fall, notably Africa, Central America, and the Asian Near East. Meanwhile, the problem of the developed world was that it produced so much surplus food that it did not know what to do with it, and in the 1980s decided to grow substantially less, or else, as in the European community, to dump its butter mountains and milk lakes below cost, thus undercutting producers in the poor countries. It became cheaper to buy Dutch cheese on Caribbean islands than in the Netherlands. Curiously, the contrast between food surpluses on one side, hungry people on the other, which had so outraged the world during the Great Depression of the 1930s, caused less comment in the late 20th century. It was an aspect of the growing divergence between the rich and the poor world which became increasingly evident from the 1960s. The industrial world was, of course, expanding everywhere, in the capitalist and socialist regions and in the Third World. In the Old West, there were dramatic examples of industrial revolution, such as Spain and Finland. In the world of really existing socialism, purely agrarian countries like Bulgaria and Romania acquired massive industrial sectors. In the Third World, the most spectacular development of the so-called newly industrializing countries, NICs, occurred after the Golden Age, but everywhere the number of countries depending primarily on agriculture, at least for financing their imports from the rest of the world, diminished sharply. By the later 1980s, a mere 15 states paid for half their imports or more from farm exports. With one exception, New Zealand, all were in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. The world economy was thus growing at an explosive rate. By the 1960s, it was plain that there had never been anything like it. World output of manufactures quadrupled between the early 1950s and the early 1970s, and, what is even more impressive, world trade in manufactured products grew tenfold. As we have seen, world agricultural output also shot up, if not so spectacularly. It did so not so much, as so often in the past, by bringing new land into cultivation, but rather by raising its productivity. Grain yields per hectare almost doubled between 1950 to 1952 and 1980 to 1982, and more than doubled in North America, Western Europe, and East Asia. World fisheries, meanwhile, trebled their catches before falling again. One byproduct of this extraordinary explosion was as yet barely noticed, though in retrospect it already looked menacing: pollution and ecological deterioration. During the Golden Age, it attracted little attention, except from wildlife enthusiasts and other protectors of human and natural rarities, because the dominant ideology of progress took it for granted that the growing domination of nature by man was the very measure of humanity's advance. Industrialization in the socialist countries was for this reason particularly blind to the ecological consequences of its massive construction of a rather archaic industrial system based on iron and smoke. Even in the West, the old 19th century businessman's motto, "Where there's muck, there's brass," that is to say, pollution means money, was still convincing, especially for road builders and real estate developers who rediscovered the unbelievable profits to be made in an era of secular boom from speculation which could not go wrong. All one had to do was to wait for the value of the right building site to rise into the stratosphere. A single well-sited building could now make a man a multimillionaire virtually without cost, since he could borrow on the security of his future construction and borrow further as its value, built or unbuilt, occupied or empty, continued to go up. Eventually, as usual, there was a crash. The Golden Age ended like earlier booms in a real estate come banking collapse. But until then, city centres, large and small, were ripped out and developed across the world, incidentally destroying medieval cathedral cities like Worcester in Britain or Spanish colonial capitals like Lima in Peru. Since the authorities in both East and West also discovered that something like factory methods could be used to construct public housing quickly and cheaply, filling the outskirts of cities with blankly menacing high-rise apartment blocks, the 1960s will probably go down as the most disastrous decade in the history of human urbanization. In fact, far from worrying about the environment, there seem to be grounds for self-satisfaction, as the results of 19th century pollution yielded to 20th century technology and ecological conscience. Did not the simple banning of coal fires in London from 1953 abolish at one stroke the impenetrable fog so familiar from Charles Dickens's novels, which had periodically blanketed the city? Were not, some years later, salmon once again swimming up the once dead River Thames? Cleaner, smaller, quieter factories distributed themselves around the countryside instead of the vast smoke-swathed plants that had previously signified industry. Airports replaced railway stations as the quintessential buildings representing transport. As the countryside emptied, people, or at least middle-class people, moving into abandoned villages and farmsteads, could feel themselves closer than ever to nature. Yet there is no denying that the impact of human activities on nature, primarily urban and industrial, but also, it was eventually realized, agricultural, increased steeply from the middle of the century. This was largely due to the enormous increase in the use of fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, and so on, whose potential exhaustion had worried earlier gazers into the future from the mid-19th century on. New sources were discovered faster than they could be used. That total energy consumption shot up, it actually tripled in the USA between 1950 and 1973, is far from surprising. One of the reasons why the Golden Age was golden was that the price of a barrel of Saudi oil averaged less than $2 throughout the entire period from 1950 to 1973, thus making energy ridiculously cheap and getting cheaper all the time. Ironically, it was only after 1973 when the oil producers' cartel OPEC finally decided to charge what the traffic would bear that ecology watchers took serious note of the effects of the consequent explosion in petrol-driven traffic, which was already darkening the skies above the great cities in the motorized and, in particular, the American parts of the world. Smog was the immediate worry, and understandably so. However, carbon dioxide emissions warming the atmosphere almost tripled between 1950 and 1973. That is to say, the concentration of this gas in the atmosphere increased by a little less than 1% a year. The production of chlorofluorocarbons, chemicals which affect the ozone layer, rose almost vertically. At the end of the war, they had barely been used. But by 1974, over 300,000 tons of one compound and over 400,000 tons of another were being released into the atmosphere each year. The rich Western countries naturally generated the lion's share of this pollution, though the unusually filthy industrialization of the USSR produced almost as much carbon dioxide as the USA, almost five times as much in 1985 as in 1950. Per capita, of course, the USA remained a long way ahead. Only Britain actually lowered the amount emitted per inhabitant over this period. 2. Initially, this astonishing explosion of the economy seemed merely a gigantic version of what had gone before, as it were, a globalization of the state of the pre-1945 USA, taking that country as the model of a capitalist industrial society. So, to some extent, it was. The age of the automobile had long arrived in North America, but after the war, it came to Europe, and later, more modestly, to the socialist world and the Latin American middle classes, while cheap fuel made the truck and the bus the major means of transport over most of the globe's landmass. If the rise of Western affluent society could be measured by the multiplication of private cars, from Italy's 750,000 in 1938 to the same country's 15 millions in 1975, the economic development of many a third world country could be recognized by the rate at which the number of its trucks grew. Much of the great world boom was thus a catching up, or in the USA, a continuation of old trends. The model of Henry Ford's mass production spread across the oceans to new auto industries, while in the USA, the Fordist principle was extended to new kinds of production, from house building to junk food. McDonald's was a post-war success story. Goods and services previously confined to minorities were now produced for a mass market, as in the field of mass travel to sunny beaches. Before the war, never had more than 150,000 North Americans travelled to Central America and the Caribbean in any year, but between 1950 and 1970 their numbers grew from 300,000 to 7 million. The European figures were not surprisingly even more spectacular. Spain, which had virtually no mass tourism until the later 1950s, welcomed over 54 million of foreigners per year at the end of the 1980s, a number only slightly surpassed by Italy's 55 million. What had once been luxury became the expected standard of comfort, at all events in the rich countries: the refrigerator, the private washing machine, the telephone. By 1971, there were over 270 million telephones in the world. That is to say, overwhelmingly in North America and Western Europe, and their spread was accelerating. 10 years later, their numbers had almost doubled. In the developed market economies, there was more than one phone for every two inhabitants. In short, it was now possible for the average citizen in those countries to live as only the very wealthy had lived in their parents' day, except, of course, that mechanization had now replaced personal servants. However, what strikes us most about the period is the extent to which the economic surge seemed powered by technological revolution. To this extent, it multiplied not only improved products of the old kind, but quite unprecedented ones, including many which had been virtually unimagined before the war. Some revolutionary products, such as the synthetic materials known as plastics, had been developed between the wars or even begun to enter commercial production, like nylon, 1935, polystyrene and polythene. Some, like television and recording on magnetic tape, were then barely out of the experimental stage. The war, with its demands on high technology, prepared a number of revolutionary processes for later civilian use, though rather more on the British side, subsequently taken up by the USA, than among the science-minded Germans. Radar, the jet engine, and various ideas and techniques which prepared the ground for post-war electronics and information technology. Without them, the transistor, invented 1947, and the first civilian digital computers, 1946, would certainly have appeared considerably later. Perhaps, fortunately, nuclear energy, first mobilized during the war for destruction, remained largely outside the civilian economy except as a, so far, marginal contribution to the world's generation of electrical energy, about 5% in 1975. Whether these innovations were based on interwar or post-war science, or interwar technical or even commercial pioneering, or on the great post-1945 forward rush, the integrated circuits developed in the 1950s, the lasers of the 1960s, or the various spin-offs from space rocketry, hardly matters for our purpose. Except in one sense. More than any previous period, the Golden Age rested on the most advanced and often esoteric scientific research, which now found practical application within a few years. Industry and even agriculture, for the first time, moved decisively beyond the technology of the 19th century. Three things about this technological earthquake strike the observer. First, it utterly transformed everyday life in the rich world, and even to a lesser extent in the poor world, where radio could now reach the remotest villages thanks to the transistor and the miniaturized long-life battery, where the Green Revolution transformed rice and wheat cultivation, and plastic sandals replaced bare feet. Any European reader of this book who makes a quick inventory of his or her personal possessions can verify this. Most of the contents of the refrigerator or freezer, neither of which most family homes would have owned in 1945, is novel. Freeze-dried food, factory-farmed poultry produce, meat stuffed with enzymes and various chemicals to change its taste, or even constructed by the simulation of boneless high-quality cuts, not to mention products imported fresh by air from halfway across the globe, as would then have been impossible. Compared to 1950, the share of natural or traditional materials, wood, metal treated in old-fashioned ways, natural fibres or fillings, even ceramics, in our kitchens, household furnishings and personal clothing, has gone down dramatically, although the hype surrounding everything produced by the personal hygiene and beauty industry was such that it obscured, by systematically exaggerating, the degree of novelty of its enormously increased and diversified output. For technological revolution entered consumer consciousness to such an extent that novelty became the main sales appeal for everything from synthetic detergents, which came into their own in the 1950s, to laptop computers. The assumption was that new equaled not just better, but utterly revolutionized. As for the products visibly representing technological novelty, their list is endless and needs no comment. Television, vinyl records, LPs came in 1948, followed by tapes, tape cassettes came in the 1960s, and compact discs, small portable transistor radios. The present writer got his first as a present from a Japanese friend in the late 1950s. Digital watches, pocket calculators, battery and then solar-powered, and then the rest of domestic electronics, photo and video equipment. Not the least significant thing about these innovations is the systematic process of miniaturization of such products, that is to say, portability, which vastly extended their potential range and market. However, the technological revolution was perhaps symbolized just as much as superficially unchanged products, which had, since the Second World War, been transformed from top to bottom, such as pleasure sailing boats. Their masts and hulls, their sails and rigging, their navigational equipment had little or nothing in common with interwar vessels except shape and function. Second, the more complex the technology involved, the more complex was the road from discovery or invention to production, and the more elaborate and expensive the process of traversing it. Research and development, R&D, became central to economic growth, and for this reason, the already enormous advantage of the developed market economies over the rest was reinforced. As we shall see in Chapter 16, technological innovation did not flourish in the socialist economies. The typical developed country had upwards of 1,000 scientists and engineers for every million of its population in the 1970s, but Brazil had about 250, India 130, Pakistan about 60, Kenya and Nigeria about 30. Moreover, the process of innovation became so continuous that the cost of developing new products became an increasingly large and indispensable share of the cost of production. In the extreme case of the armaments industries, where admittedly money was no object, new devices had barely become fit for practical use before they were scrapped for even more advanced and, of course, vastly more expensive pieces of equipment, to the considerable financial benefit of the corporations concerned. In the more mass-market-oriented industries, such as pharmaceutical chemicals, a new and genuinely needed drug, especially when protected from competition by patent rights, could make several fortunes, which were explained away by its producers as absolutely essential for further research. Less easily protected innovators had to clean up more quickly, for as soon as other products entered the market, the price dropped through the floor. Third, the new technologies were, overwhelmingly, capital-intensive and, except for the highly skilled scientists and technicians, labour-saving or even labour-replacing. The major characteristic of the Golden Age was that it needed constant and heavy investment and, increasingly, that it did not need people, except as consumers. However, the impetus and speed of the economic surge was such that, for a generation, this was not obvious. On the contrary, the economy grew so fast that even in the industrial countries, the industrial working class maintained or even increased its share of the occupied population. In all advanced countries but the USA, the reserve lakes of labour filled during pre-war depression and post-war demobilisation were drained. New supplies of labour were sucked in from the native countryside and from foreign immigration, and married women, hitherto kept outside the labour market, entered it in growing numbers. Nevertheless, the ideal to which the Golden Age aspired, though it was only gradually realized, was production, or even service, without humans. Automated robots assembling cars, silent voids filled with banks of computers controlling the output of power, trains without drivers. Human beings were essential to such an economy only in one respect, as buyers of goods and services. Here lay its central problem. In the Golden Age, it still seemed unreal and remote, like the future death of the universe by entropy, about which Victorian scientists had warned the human race. On the contrary, all the problems which have haunted capitalism in its era of catastrophe appeared to dissolve and to disappear. The terrible and inevitable cycle of boom and slump, so murderous between the wars, became a succession of mild fluctuations thanks to, or so the Keynesian economists who now advised governments were convinced, their intelligent macroeconomic management. Mass unemployment, where it was to be found in the developed world in the 1960s, when Europe averaged 1.5% of its labour force out of work and Japan 1.3%. Only in North America was it not yet eliminated. Poverty? Of course, most of humanity remained poor, but in the old heartlands of industrial labour, what meaning could the internationals, arise ye starvelings from your slumbers, have for workers who now expected to have their car and spend their annual paid vacation on the beaches of Spain? And if they fell upon hard times, would not an increasingly universal and generous welfare state provide them with protection undreamed of before against the hazards of ill health, misfortune, even the dreaded old age of the poor? Their incomes rose year by year almost automatically. Would they not go on rising forever? The range of goods and services offered by the productive system and available to them made former luxuries part of everyday consumption. It widened year by year. What more, in material terms, could humanity want except to extend the benefits already enjoyed by the favoured peoples of some countries to the unhappy inhabitants of those parts of the world, admittedly still the majority of mankind, who had not yet entered upon development and modernisation? What problems remained to be solved? An extremely intelligent and prominent British socialist politician wrote in 1956, "Traditionally, socialist thought has been dominated by the economic problems posed by capitalism, poverty, mass unemployment, squalor, instability, and even the possibility of the collapse of the whole system. Capitalism had been reformed out of all recognition. Despite occasional minor recessions and balance of payments crises, full employment and at least a tolerable degree of stability are likely to be maintained. Automation can be expected steadily to solve any remaining problems of underproduction. Looking ahead, our present rate of growth will give us a national output 3 times as high in 50 years. 3. How are we to explain this extraordinary and quite unexpected triumph of a system which for half a lifetime had seemed on the verge of ruin? What needs explaining, of course, is not the mere fact of a lengthy period of economic expansion and well-being following on a similar period of economic and other troubles and disturbances. Such a succession of long waves of about half a century in length has formed the basic rhythm of the economic history of capitalism since the late 18th century. As we have seen, the age of catastrophe has drawn attention to this pattern of secular fluctuations, whose nature remains obscure. They are generally known by the name of the Russian economist Kondratiev. In the long perspective, the Golden Age was just another Kondratiev upswing, like the great Victorian boom of 1850 to 1873. Curiously, the dates almost coincide at a century's distance, and the Belle Epoque of the late Victorians and Edwardians. Like earlier such upswings, it was preceded and followed by downswings. What needs explaining is not this, but the extraordinary scale and depth of this secular boom, which is a sort of pendant to the extraordinary scale and depth of the preceding era of crises and depressions. There are no really satisfactory explanations for the sheer scale of this great leap forward of the capitalist world economy, and consequently for its unprecedented social consequences. Of course, other countries had enormous scope for catching up with the model economy of early 20th century industrial society, the USA, a country devastated by neither war, defeat nor victory, though briefly shaken by the great slump. Other countries did indeed systematically try to imitate the USA, a process which speeded up economic development, since it is always easier to adapt an existing technology than to invent a new one. That, as the Japanese example was to show, could come later. However, there was clearly more to the great leap than this. There was a substantial restructuring and reform of capitalism and a quite spectacular advance in the globalization and internationalization of the economy. They first produced a mixed economy, which both made it easier for states to plan and manage economic modernization, and which also enormously increased demand. The great post-war economic success stories of capitalist countries, with the rarest exceptions, Hong Kong, are stories of industrialization backed, supervised, steered, and sometimes planned and managed by governments, from France and Spain in Europe to Japan, Singapore, and South Korea. At the same time, the political commitment of governments to full employment and, to a lesser extent, to the lessening of economic inequality, that is to say, a commitment to welfare and social security, for the first time provided a mass consumer market for luxury goods which could now become accepted as necessities. The poorer people are, the higher the proportion of their income they must spend on indispensable essentials such as food, a sensible observation known as Engel's Law. In the 1930s, even in the rich USA, about a third of household expenditure still went on food. But by the early 1980s, only 13%. The rest was available for other expenditures. The Golden Age democratized the market. The second multiplied the productive capacity of the world economy by making possible a far more elaborate and sophisticated international division of labor. Initially, this was largely confined to the collective of the so-called developed market economies, that is to say, the countries in the US camp. The socialist part of the world was largely separate, and the most dynamic developers in the Third World in the 1950s opted for a segregated and planned industrialization by substituting their own production for imported manufactures. The core countries of Western capitalism, of course, traded with the overseas world, and very advantageously too, since the terms of trade favoured them. That is to say, they could get their raw materials and foodstuffs more cheaply. Still, what really exploded was the trade in industrial products, mainly between the industrial core countries. World trade in manufactures multiplied over tenfold in the 20 years after 1953. Manufactures, which had formed a fairly constant share of world trade since the 19th century at a little less than half, now shot up to over 60%. The Golden Age remained anchored to the economies of the core capitalist countries, even in pure quantitative terms. In 1975, the Big Seven of capitalism alone, Canada, the USA, Japan, France, Federal Germany, Italy, and Great Britain, contained three-quarters of all the passenger cars on the globe and almost as high a proportion of its telephones. Nevertheless, the new industrial revolution could not be confined to any region. The restructuring of capitalism and the advance in economic internationalization were central. It is not so clear that technological revolution explains the Golden Age, though there was plenty of it. As has been shown, much of the new industrialization of these decades was the spread of old industrializations based on old technologies to new countries. The 19th century industrialization of coal, iron and steel to the socialist agrarian countries, the 20th century American industries of oil and internal combustion engines to European ones. The impact of the high research-generated technology on civilian industry probably did not become massive until the crisis decades after 1973, when the major breakthrough of information technology and genetic engineering took place, as well as a number of other leaps into the unknown. Perhaps the chief innovations which began to transform the world almost as soon as the war ended were chemical and pharmaceutical. Their impact on the demography of the Third World was immediate. Their cultural effects were a little more delayed, but not much, for the Western sexual revolution of the 1960s and 1970s was made possible by antibiotics, unknown before the Second World War, which appeared to remove the major risks from sexual promiscuity by making venereal diseases easily curable, and by the birth control pill, which became widely available in the 1960s. The risk was to return to sex in the 1980s with AIDS. All the same, an innovating high technology soon became so much part of the great boom that it must form part of any explanation, even if we do not regard it as decisive in its own right. Post-war capitalism was unquestionably, as the Crossland quotation put it, a system reformed out of all recognition, or, in the words of the British Premier Harold Macmillan, a new version of the old system. What happened was far more than a return of the system from some avoidable interwar errors to its normal record of both maintaining a high level of employment and enjoying some non-negligible rate of economic growth. Essentially, it was a sort of marriage between economic liberalism and social democracy, or in American terms, Rooseveltian New Deal policy, with substantial borrowings from the USSR, which had pioneered the idea of economic planning. That is why the reaction against it by the theological free marketeers was to be so impassioned in the 1970s and 1980s, when the policies based on this marriage were no longer protected by economic success. Men like the Austrian economist Friedrich von Hayek, 1899 to 1992, had never been pragmatists, ready, if reluctant, to be persuaded that economic activities which interfered with laissez-faire worked, though of course they denied, with subtle arguments, that they could work. They were believers in the equation free market equals freedom of the individual, and consequently condemned any departure from it as, to quote the title of his 1944 book, The Road to Serfdom. They had stood by the purity of the market in the Great Slump. They continued to condemn the policies which made the Golden Age golden as the world grew richer and capitalism plus political liberalism flourished again on the basis of mixing markets and governments. But between the 1940s and the 1970s, nobody listened to such old believers. Nor can we doubt that capitalism was deliberately reformed, largely by the men who were in a position to do so in the USA and Britain during the last war years. It is a mistake to suppose that people never learn from history. The interwar experience, and especially the Great Slump, had been so catastrophic that nobody could possibly dream, as plenty of men in public life had done after the First World War, of returning as soon as possible to the time before the air raid sirens had begun to sound. All the men, women were hardly yet accepted into the first division of public life, who sketched out what they hoped would be the post-war principles of the world economy and the future of the global economic order, had lived through the Great Slump. Some, like J.M. Keynes, had been in public life since before 1914. And if the economic memory of the 1930s was not enough to sharpen their appetite for reforming capitalism, the fatal political risks of not doing so were patent to all who had just fought Hitler's Germany, the child of the Great Slump, and were confronted with the prospect of communism and Soviet power advancing westwards across the ruins of capitalist economies that did not work. Four things seemed clear to these decision-makers. The interwar catastrophe, which must on no account be allowed to return, had been due largely to the breakdown of the global trading and financial system and the consequent fragmentation of the world into would-be autarkic national economies or empires. The global system had once been stabilized by the hegemony, or at least the centrality, of the British economy and its currency, the pound sterling. Between the wars, Britain and sterling were no longer strong enough to carry this load, which could now only be taken over by the USA and the dollar. The conclusion, naturally, aroused more genuine enthusiasm in Washington than elsewhere. Third, the Great Slump had been due to the failure of the unrestricted free market. Henceforth, the market would have to be supplemented by, or to work from within, the framework of public planning and economic management. Finally, for social and political reasons, mass unemployment must not be allowed to return. Decision-makers outside the Anglo-Saxon countries could do little about the reconstruction of the world trading and financial system, but found the rejection of the old free market liberalism congenial enough. Strong state guidance and state planning in economic matters were not new in several countries from France to Japan. Even the state ownership and management of industries was familiar enough and had been widely extended in Western countries after 1945. It was in no sense a particular issue between socialists and anti-socialists, although the general leftward swing of wartime resistance politics gave it more prominence than it would have had before the war, as for instance in the French and Italian constitutions of 1946 to 1947. Thus, even after 15 years of socialist government, Norway in 1960 had a proportionately and, of course, absolutely smaller public sector than West Germany, which was not a country given to nationalisation. As for the socialist parties and labour movements, which were so prominent in Europe after the war, they fitted in readily with the new reformed capitalism because, for practical purposes, they had no economic policy of their own except for the communists, whose policy consisted in gaining power and then following the model of the USSR. The pragmatic Scandinavians left their private sectors intact. The British Labour government of 1945 did not, but did nothing whatever to reform it, and showed a lack of interest in planning that was quite startling, especially when contrasted with the enthusiastic planned modernisation of contemporary and non-socialist French governments. In effect, the left concentrated on improving the conditions of their working-class constituencies and social reforms for this purpose. Since they had no alternative solutions, except to call for the abolition of capitalism, which no social democratic government knew how to, or try to, abolish, they had to rely on a strong wealth-creating capitalist economy to finance their aims. In effect, a reformed capitalism which recognised the importance of labour and social democratic aspirations suited them well enough. In short, for a variety of reasons, the politicians, officials, and even many of the businessmen of the post-war West were convinced that a return to laissez-faire and the unreconstructed free market were out of the question. Certain policy objectives, full employment, the containment of communism, the modernization of lagging or declining or ruined economies, had absolute priority and justified the strongest government presence. Even regimes dedicated to economic and political liberalism now could and had to run their economies in ways which would once have been rejected as socialist. After all, that is how Britain and even the USA had run their war economies. The future lay with the mixed economy, though there were moments when the old orthodoxies of fiscal rectitude, stable currencies and stable prices still counted. Even these were no longer absolutely compelling. Since 1933, the scarecrows of inflation and deficit finance no longer kept the birds away from the economic fields, but the crops still seemed to grow. These were not minor changes. They led a US statesman of ironclad capitalist credentials, Averell Harriman, in 1946, to tell his countrymen, "People in this country are no longer scared of such words as planning. People have accepted the fact the government has got to plan as well as individuals in this country." They made it natural for a champion of economic liberalism and admirer of the US economy, Jean Monnet, 1888 to 1979, to become a passionate backer of French economic planning. They turned Lionel, Lord Robbins, a free market economist who had once defended orthodoxy against Keynes and run a seminar jointly with Hayek at the London School of Economics, into a director of the semi-socialist British war economy. For 30 years or so, there was a consensus among Western thinkers and decision-makers, notably in the USA, which determined what other countries on the non-communist side could do, or rather what they could not do. All wanted a world of rising production, growing foreign trade, full employment, industrialization and modernization, and all were prepared to achieve it, if need be, through systematic government control and the management of mixed economies, and by cooperating with organized labor movements so long as they were not communist. The golden age of capitalism would have been impossible without this consensus that the economy of private enterprise, free enterprise was the preferred name, needed to be saved from itself to survive. However, though capitalism certainly reformed itself, we must make a clear distinction between the general readiness to do the hitherto unthinkable and the actual effectiveness of the specific new recipes which the chefs of the new economic restaurants were creating. This is hard to judge. Economists, like politicians, are always inclined to put down success to the sagacity of their policies, and during the Golden Age, when even weak economies like the British flourished and grew, there seemed plenty of scope for self-congratulation. Still, deliberate policy undoubtedly scored some striking successes. In 1945 to 1946, France, for instance, set out quite consciously on a course of economic planning to modernize the French industrial economy. This adaptation of Soviet ideas to a capitalist mixed economy must have had some effect, since between 1950 and 1979, France, hitherto a byword for economic retardation, caught up more successfully than any other of the chief industrial countries with US productivity, more so even than Germany. Nevertheless, we must leave the economists, a notably contentious tribe, to argue out the merits and demerits and the efficacy of the various policies of the various governments, mostly associated with the name of J.M. Keynes, who had died in 1946.